I am yesterday, today, and tomorrow. I have the power to be born a second time. I am the source and creator of all the gods. Peace of nirvana in the womb, the bliss of relationship to the mother goddess. And man was not breathed into the earth. Man came out of the earth. Dreams are self-luminous. They shine of themselves, as gods do. Myths are public dreams. Dreams are private myths. By finding your own dream and following it through, it will lead you to the myth world in which you live. The passage is from dream to vision to the gods, and they are you. All the gods, all the hells, all the heavens are within you. The God is in you. It is not something that happened somewhere else a long time ago. It's in you. This is the truth of truths. This is what the gods and myths are all about. So find them in yourself and take them into yourself, and you will be awakened in your mythology and in your life. In deep, dreamless sleep, consciousness is still there, but it is covered over by darkness. But suppose you could find that consciousness. Suppose you could go into deep sleep, awake. To go awake into that sphere where there is consciousness, but consciousness of no specific thing. Waking consciousness deals only with what has happened. Deep sleep holds all that is future, because the future can come from nowhere else but the energies of the psyche. In the Bronze Age mythology, which is the basic mythology of antiquity, the lion is associated with the solar image. Now, the moon dies into the sun every month and is born from it again. So the sun is the mother of the moon. The animal associated with the sun primarily is the lion, whose wonderful solar face and his roar scatters the animals of the grazing plain as the rising sun scatters the stars of night. The lion is the great image of the power of consciousness and energy. the solar lion, the womb of woman, and the sacrificial fire are the same fire. They are the transforming fire. And so all is within the mother. She is time, space, causality. This is from 1500 BC in Crete, a little image that was in the chapel at the royal palace at Knossos. She is the giver of life, and she is the giver of nourishment. The serpent, the goddess associated with the serpent, the Garden of Eden, Eve, and the serpent. The serpent sheds its skin to be born again, as the moon sheds its shadow to be born again. Moon and serpent represent the power of life to throw off death and come to new birth. The animal associated with the moon, as the lion is associated with the sun, typically is the bull, whose beautiful horns resemble or suggest the horns of the crescent moon. And as the moon dies to be resurrected, so in rituals, the bull is killed to be resurrected. This is the energy and consciousness of life engaged in the field of time. Where there is time, there is inevitably birth and death. Where there is time, there is inevitably sorrow. The loss of what was valued. And it's always in terms of pairs of opposites. In the field of time, everything is experienced in terms of opposites. But then the knowledge beyond and beneath that of the transcendent, that which transcends duality. Adam and Eve were thrown out of the Garden of Unity when they knew of the pairs of opposites. The sun does not carry a shadow in itself. When the sun sets, the light sets with the sun. It is not the sun that is in darkness, but we who are. And so the sun represents the light and energy of life and consciousness, not engaged in the field of time, disengaged, absolute. In Buddhism, the light is called the mother light, the light of consciousness, the undifferentiated light of consciousness, the mother light. Or you can read it the other way around, as in India, Kali, whose name means the black and also means time, the black source out of which all comes, black into which it goes. In the East, the whole universe, the sphere of the universe, is the womb of the goddess. And the deities and all names and forms are within her bounds. The gods are her children. This is a primary mythology. This is the mythology from which all our mythologies come. This is the mythology of the goddess. The goddess and woman as the initiator, opening the eye of inner vision, vision that goes past the veil that is spread before us by the vision of the two eyes, opening the ear to the music of the spheres, opening consciousness to a transpersonal realm of experience, the opening of the wisdom body to the voice of the wisdom of nature and the world round about. That serpent in the garden, he knew where he was. He was an old, old deity who was the consort of the goddess. And Eve was that consort. The serpent and Eve make a better pair than Eve and Adam. Serpent and Eve were at the tree of bliss. Adam and Eve are out there having a tough time. You know, this is a terrible tradition, a degradation and denial of nature, and the serpent cursed and woman along with it. They eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and God thinks, I mean, it says so, I'm not making this up. God thinks, and now that they've eaten of this fruit, lest they should eat the fruit of the other tree in the garden, the tree of immortal life, and become as we are, Elohim is a plural noun, therefore, God kicks them out of the garden. In our religious system of the West, which is based on an idea of a fallen nature, a good nature into which a negative power has infused evil, we have the idea of a conflict between good and evil. And so we are invited to stand for the good against the evil. And we do not have a religion like almost everybody else of the world, putting yourself in accord with nature. I think what happens in our mythology is that the symbols, the mythological archetypal symbols, became interpreted as facts. I think it starts with the Old Testament. I think with the Old Testament, God is a fact, not a symbol. And the Holy Land is that place and no other. And man is superior to the beasts. And nature is fallen. With the fall in the Garden of Eden, nature is corrupt. So we do not give ourselves to nature. We will correct nature. There is good and evil in nature. And we are supposed to be on the side of the good. So there is a tension. You don't yield to nature. These are nature worshippers. But what else have you got to worship? Some figment of your imagination that you've put up in the clouds. And so we've lost the symbols. Meanwhile, we need the symbols. And they come up in disturbed dreams and nightmares and so forth, which are dealt with by the psychiatrists. It was with Freud and Jung and Adler that it was realized, and particularly through Jung, that the figures of dream are really figures of personal mythologization. You're creating your own imagery related to the archetypes. But the culture has rejected them. The culture has gone into an economic and political phase where the spiritual principles are completely disregarded. The religious life is ethical. It is not mystical. That is gone. And the society is disintegrating, consequently. It is. The question is, will there ever be a recovery of the mythological, mystical realization of the miracle of life, of which our society is a manifestation, and all of us, brothers and sisters, in the spirit of this all-informing mythos? There's no conflict between mysticism and science, but there is a conflict between the science of 2000 BC and the science of 2000 AD, and that's the mess in our religions. We've got stuck with an image of the universe that is about as simple and childish as you could imagine. You know, the three-level universe and all that of the Bible. It's of no use to us. We have to have poets. We have to have seers who will render to us the experience of the transcendent through the world in which we're living. I heard from an astronaut a fabulous statement. He was in one of the modules on one of these trips, and he was to go out of the module, and he's going through space at 18,000 miles an hour, and there was no wind, and there was no sound, and over there was the sun, and over here was the earth, and there was the moon, and this beautiful man said, I asked myself what I had ever done to have this experience. Now, there all bearings are shattered. This is what is known as the sublime. And the amusing thing to me is that the mythology that really fits what's being discovered now is Hinduism. The earth is the energy of which the god is a personification and of which matter is a concretization. And the eons and eons and eons of time. Vishnu sleeps on the cosmic serpent. That cosmic serpent floats on the cosmic sea. And Vishnu, in that sleep, dreams the dream that is the universe. The lotus of a universe rises. On the lotus sits a Brahma. And every time Brahma opens his eyes, a world age comes into being, governed by an Indra. He closes his eyes. He opens his eyes. Another world age, he closes his eyes. This goes on for 360 divine years, eyes opening and closing, and then the lotus dissolves, and it goes back. Another lotus, another Brahma, opening, closing. And then he says, consider the galaxies, in the infinitudes of space, each with its lotus, with its Brahma, eyes opening, eyes closing. There was a flood. The whole world was drowned in a flood. And here is the goddess Earth, who is down in the abyss of the waters. And Vishnu turns himself into a boar, a gigantic boar, which plunges them to the bottom of the water and takes the goddess and carries her back to light. And as he's carrying her back, he says, every time I carry you this way, that means every 90 billion years this thing happens. And the wonderful thing is this expansion of the notion of time, which diminishes our notion of the importance of the present moment and makes it possible for us to see it as but a flash on the surface of the waters of eternity. Thank you. just at the time of Akhenaten, that's the 1377 to 1358 or so, the Indo-Europeans are invading India. They're nomads, warrior people with their priest magicians. And wherever they went, the priests would build a symbolic altar in the symbolic form of the cosmos, light the fire, and that would be the god Agni, the god of fire, who would be, as it were, the mouth of the gods. They chant then hymns which invoke the gods. These hymns are the works of poets, but they're not invented hymns, they're heard hymns. The Vedas are called Shruti, that which has been heard. The ear has opened to the song of the universe. An unquenchable fire, the god Agni. And the offering that's poured in is also divine. This is a god named Soma. Just as the Greeks poured libations of wine, so the Soma juice is poured into the fire. But the word Soma refers to a deity who is identical in a way with the moon. You could see the moon filling every month with ambrosia, amrita, the elixir of immortality, and then it declines as though it were emptying with the dew. The dew is symbolic of this ambrosia, which refreshes the world of vegetation after the burning, fierce fire of the tropical sun, which desiccates. When you take food to your mouth and eat it, the fire in your body consumes the food. This is equivalent to the sacrifice at the fire. And so the energy is within you. And so why put all your thoughts and mind on the Brahmins and their sacrifices? Why not seek to know the power that's within yourself? This is the doctrine of what are called the forest books, the Upanishads, sitting close in to a teacher who teaches you close in doctrine, and it is, you are it. Tattvam asi. The yogi says, Shivoham, I am Shiva, I'm it, I'm that power, and you are. People are caught in samsara, in the vortex of birth, death, sorrow, and so forth. We are to renounce those actions in life which engage us in this vortex, move into the forest, disengage ourselves, engage in meditation, and achieve the rapture condition of nirvanic harmony. There was an early form of Buddhism where this escape from life was taken seriously. The Buddhism of the doctrine of the ancients. It's also known as the Hinayana Buddhism, the little ferry boat Buddhism. Because in order to follow this Buddhism, you must give up the world and step into the little monk ferry boat that will carry you to the yonder shore. During the first century AD, that's 500 years after the Buddhist time, a new order of Buddhism comes into form in northwest India. It is the Buddhism known as the Mahayana, the big or great ferry boat Buddhism. Now, to explain the difference between the two, I'm going to use a little anecdote that my friend of long ago, Heinrich Zimmer, once proposed. The Bay Area, with San Francisco on this side, and over there across the bay, Berkeley, with all the wise men there. So you're fed up with San Francisco. You're absolutely in disgust of life. And you've heard about Berkeley. You've heard about Nirvana. And you've heard what a peaceful, wonderful place it is, and what spiritual life there is over there. So you go down to the shore and you keep look day after day over at Berkeley. This is the desire for the experience, you know, of Nirvana. One fine day, a ferry boat sets out from the yonder shore, comes right to your feet. And in the ferry boat, there is a man who says, "Anyone for Berkeley?" And you say, "I." And he says, "Get aboard." But there's a consideration. Namely, this is a one-way trip. Now the texts say, unless you are as eager for nirvanic bliss as a man whose hair is on fire would be for a pond into which to dive, don't start. It's too tough. So you get in the boat, and the boat starts out, and you have a pang. You think, mother, or something like that. But it's too late now, and you're out in the water. And now it's ship ahoy. The splash of the waves on the hull of the boat. You thought it was going to be a short trip. It may take six incarnations. You're now a monk. And it's such a real relief and pleasure counting the beads in this hand and then over here, putting little flowers on altars and so forth. Life has been reduced to such simplicities that there's nothing, no problems at all. The last thing you want now is to get ashore on the other shore where something else might happen. One fine incarnation or another, the boat scrapes ashore. This is that moment of rapture, you know. But you can't live in that. We're there. So you get ashore, it's a new life, a new breeze, and all that sort of thing. And then you think, well, I wonder how San Francisco looks from here. Now we're going to move into the other kind of Buddhism. This has been Hinayana Buddhism. Only those willing to give up everything, monks and nuns and so forth, and to play the little game of rosaries and flowers, they can get onto this trip. I wonder what San Francisco looks like from here. Forgetting that you're in the realm beyond pairs of opposites. Turn around this. No San Francisco. There's no bay between. There's no ferry boat. There's no Buddha. This is it. This is known as the Mahayana. We're all there. And who's there? Well, the first doctrine of Buddhism is Anatman. All things are without a self. So who's on the boat anyhow? Didn't you realize that? We are all simply illusions of a consciousness that is the real ground. This is the illusion that comes with the rippling waters of a pond. Broken images that come and go. We identified ourselves with one of those that comes and goes. That was when we were in San Francisco. Now we have identified ourselves with the Buddha consciousness, which informs all things, and we're at peace. We can open our eyes and return to the world. We're in San Francisco. You see what we get? So this is known as the Buddhism of the Great Delight, Mahasukha. All is sorrowful and in perfect rapture. Thank you. And that night, the Buddha comes to illumination, facing the east, and the new rising sun beholds him as a Buddha. He sat there so stunned with what he had experienced that he did not move for 7 days. And while he sat there was a terrific storm of the universe that threatened him. And the serpent king, Muchalinda, who supports the universe from beneath, and was right beneath that immovable spot himself, the serpent supporting the world, he came up and enwrapped the Buddha with his body and his serpent hoods over the Buddha's head, so he was protected from the storm. And what it shows is that the Savior, who represents the culmination of consciousness, is in accord with the serpent power of the universe. The tempter came to the Buddha in two forms, one in the form of karma, desire, the other in the form of mara, the fear, the terror of death. The gods come down and they say, for the good of mankind and the gods and the universe, please teach. And the Buddha says, I will. But what he teaches is not Buddhism. It is the way to Buddhism. So Buddhism is called a yana, a vehicle, a ferry boat. And it's a ferry boat that carries you from this shore of pain and pleasure, birth and death, pairs of opposites, across the water of the vortices of life to the yonder shore beyond duality. The ego, desires, and fears. Transcendence of these is the passage through the gate to the temple. You have to pass through fear and desire to get to the Buddha, whose hand says, don't be afraid of those two chaps. Come on. The mysteries of Eleusis, this wonderful shrine just outside of Athens, which was the sacred spot for the Athenian population, has a background way into the Bronze Age. And it survived then in the classical world through Roman times until the conversion of the Roman Empire into a Christian empire. Christianity was declared to be the only permitted religion in the Roman Empire. And so a system of violent persecution and vandalism begins. The destruction of shrines, and the more sacred the shrine, the more violent the destruction. Meanwhile, however, in the Hellenistic period, many of the earlier mystery cults had come back into manifestation. There's something in the way of a revelation was actually experienced there. And it's my belief that the great insight that St. Paul had on the road to Damascus was that the death of Christ, of Jesus, on the cross could be interpreted in terms of the classical mystery religions of the death and resurrection of the Savior. The death to one's purely material animal existence and the birth then of the spiritual life. And here are the two great goddesses. This is Demeter. And here is her daughter, Persephone, who is the one who dies and is resurrected. And this is the sacred cave out of which Hades came, or Pluto, to abduct Persephone. So this is an old, old story. In the Greek, the demon is that unconscious impulse that is the dynamic of your life and which comes to you in vision and dream. But in the Christian interpretation, it's a devil. All that a devil is a repressed demon, one who has not been recognized, one who has not been given his due, has been not allowed to play into your life, and so becomes a violent threat. This is the beautiful Olympian Apollo, who represents protection and represents the consciousness and light. The radiance, the vis of the Apollonian mind moves everywhere the muses.